Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, the day we discuss coverage of the week's news. On today's show, we are remembering Dory Maynard, tireless advocate of diversity in the media and president of the Robert C. Maynard Institute of Journalism Education, which was named for Dory's father, the legendary African-American reporter, editor, and publisher. Dory Maynard died from lung cancer on February 24th. She was 56 years old. As president of the Maynard Institute, Dory Maynard advocated for the news media to accurately portray all segments of society, particularly those often overlooked, such as communities of color. One of today's guests, Martin Reynolds, said even on her last day, she was talking about a real rethinking of the Institute and what role it needs to play. We have to see that through. So where are we when it comes to diversity in the media today? Well, the percentage of people of color in American newsrooms has stagnated at between 12 and 13% for more than a decade. That's according to the annual census released in 2013 by the American Society of News Editors. The percentage of women in the newsroom has never exceeded 38%. Also, people of color make up only 10% of newsroom supervisors. And it's really tough to get a job in the media that pays the bills, especially in the Bay Area. Many of us got started with internships, but those stats are also pretty abysmal. People of color made up 26% of newsroom interns in 2013. That is down from 40% in the 1990s. So what explains this and what can we do to change it? On today's Your Call, we are speaking with guests who work to improve these numbers. They were also close friends of Dory. Today, I'm joined by Martin Reynolds, community engagement editor for the Oakland Tribune and chair of the Maynard Institute Board's Task Force. Hi, Martin. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. I'm also joined by Linda Jew, executive director of the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism, whose mission is to cultivate and support more public interest and investigative stories produced by journalists of color, women, and youth. Linda was a founding editor with Barbara Ehrenreich of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project, whose mission is to produce compelling stories that would force this country's crisis of poverty and economic insecurity to the center of the national conversation. And Linda joins me in studio. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Your Call's Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a journalist who did a good job this week. So, Martin, let's start with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, you know, in particular, what I really liked is sort of this ongoing work that's being done by one of my colleagues, Karen Desai at the San Jose Mercury News. She's been covering this issue around the inappropriate use of psychotropic drugs on foster youth in California, and it's very timely because right now there's a real effort underway to change these laws that allow these drugs to be administered to these young people who don't actually need them. And so if you go online and look for Drugging Our Kids, you'll see a number of stories, recent ones, as well as a five-part series and a documentary. It's just really outstanding and a very important issue, especially because of the timeliness of the legislative issues that are dealing with it right now.
Wow, I just pulled this up. So this is a massive report. Who is making the decisions to drug these kids?
Well, the people who are making the decision are these physicians, psychiatrists, and what have you, who are overseeing the care of these kids. And it's just not the appropriate use of these medications. And these kids don't really have anyone to advocate for them. They're trying to essentially just sort of manage their moods and the dysfunction that may be going along with, you know, many of these troubled children with these medications that are not appropriate for the afflictions that they may have.
Wow. And so in the piece, these kids say they were silenced during their youth by the powerful drugs from L.A. to the Bay Area to Humboldt County. Karen DeSaw and photographer Di Sagano interviewed more than 175 people, including dozens and current and former foster youth who were moved and heavily medicated by a system that struggled to manage their complicated childhoods.
That's right. And we're going to be doing a showing of this documentary on March 26th down at the Tech Museum in San Jose, and there'll be a panel discussion as well with Karen and a number of psychic professionals working to really change his practice.
Wow. Well, Martin, thanks for bringing that to our attention. We should either do a show on this or have Karen on a future media show. That's Martin Reynolds, community engagement editor with the Oakland Tribune. And what about you, Linda? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
The articles that I've been reading this week have not necessarily been this week's news. I've been judging a journalism contest called the Izzy, which is sponsored by Ithaca College. And it was conceived after I.F. Stone, who's the famous investigative rabble-rouser back, you know, who through the 50s, 60s, 70s. And so I've been reading a number of extremely inspiring, in-depth articles on various issues that I wish that really in the general media I'd see more coverage about. And one of the subjects that I read about was about climate change by Naomi Klein, who wrote the book called The Shock Doctrine. And she just come out with a new book whose name is escaping me right now because my mind is so cluttered. But she also wrote several articles throughout the year. And she's taking a very, very... she's getting past all the cliches about why we're not doing anything about climate change. And she's reframing the terms of debate in much larger, I wouldn't say sociological terms, but in terms that aren't necessarily polarizing for us to understand why we're not doing anything around climate change. And one of the more original pieces of writing that I've seen yet about climate change and social justice was her analysis of how race has really been a big factor in the decisions around climate change policy. And she pointed out some very interesting specific examples. For instance, after the Sandy Hook disaster, and people were not going inside buildings where people of color were living. And she pointed out how years and years of neglect in those buildings, of not keeping up those buildings, the light fixtures, the elevators, et cetera, actually led to the killing of that poor man in the stairwell by a policeman. Mm. And she talked about how there are so many structural and institutional issues that go years back to that are now leading up to how we respond to the problems of climate change. And I think she's a great writer. I think that more people should be reading her.
Is this an article she wrote specifically about
race? That was one of the
race?
Articles she wrote for The Nation magazine.
Okay.
But she wrote a whole series of articles examining why we're not doing anything around climate change.
The race issue, especially on this, sounds fascinating. Her book, This Changes Everything.
That's right.
Yeah, we had her on just a couple of months ago. And since you brought up climate change, next week we're going to do a whole series on the water crisis in California. And there's an op-ed in the LA Times today that's pretty scary called California Has About 1 Year of Water Left. Will You Ration Now?
Yeah.
Very immediate. So thank you for that. And we're going to post these articles at yourcallradio.org. That is Linda Jew, Executive Director of the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism. Are these stories up so we can read them? It sounds like there's some great stories you've been reading for
the
awards.
Yeah, well, we haven't posted them on the awards site yet, but they will.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll post those when they're up at yourcallradio.org. And so today we are going to spend the hour remembering Dorry Maynard. You were both friends of Dorry. A lot has been written about Dorry. And I just wonder, you know, what really stands out for you? I mean, Dorry, I understand, up until the very end, fought for diversity in the media. What really stands out for you, Martin?
Well, I mean, there's so many things that stand out. I mean, first and foremost, she was just a really dear friend, someone who I loved as a person, as a mentor, and someone who I miss terribly. And so, you know, personally, her passing has hit me particularly hard just because she was someone who was just so important in my life as a person. And so I'm really, first and foremost, missing my friend. And I know that many people out there are feeling the same way about Dorry, because she had this uncanny ability to have these close relationships, real close relationships with so many people. And she's served as such a support system for many young journalists, veteran journalists, and people in general. So there's that sort of personal side that stands out. And then the other side stands out is the story about her working up until her last hours is really true. We had a call with a funder scheduled for the very morning that she passed, and she was really having difficulty breathing and was still trying to get on the call and was still insistent on being involved. She said, well, maybe we can just tell the funder that I've got an upper respiratory infection and I can just sit on the line and listen in. And, I mean, wow. This was the kind of person that she was, that she, the Institute mattered so much to her, the work that she was doing, its legacy and its future. And that's really what stands out to me.
On a personal level, Linda, you knew her personally. What really drove her to do this work?
I think, obviously, her father was a very big inspiration. But also, I think she brought her own lens to it, being the daughter of a white mother and a black father. And so I think that really informed every interaction that she had. And informed all her thinking on these issues around race and diversity in the media. And I think it enabled her to cross those bridges and speak about these issues in ways that other people could listen to her. She wasn't into polemics, you know, she wasn't into lecturing, but she was able to make her point in a very profound way.
I was watching some videos of Dory yesterday, and there was a great video. She was giving a talk, and she said, I live in a fairly poor section of Oakland. And she said, I remember going outside one day, and these two young black men were just staring at me down the block. And they were walking toward me with so much force. And I stared back at them, and they stopped right in front of me and said, Happy Mother's Day. And she said, thanks. And they walked on. And she said, you know, these are the scenes of black men that we, I mean, it's very simplistic, right? But her point was, the scenes we see of black men in the media are usually about violence. And she said, we don't see this other side that I see in my neighborhood on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And she always shared personal stories like that.
Yeah. She actually had a homeless man living in a car. He had a car he was living in. He seemed to always manage to find a really nice car to live in, and it would be parked in front of Dory's house. And he would be out there. I'd come over and visit, and he'd be out there cleaning out his car. And he would use Dory's wireless connection. I'd walk up on the front porch, and there would be his line connected to the outside socket to get his wireless service. And she would give him money every so often, that, you know, to have him do handiwork or whatever. But, she really, it was interesting how she took care of everybody around her.
Well, and she saw so many changes. I mean, what was she thinking about what we're dealing with now, about Ferguson, about Trayvon Martin, about just the intense conversation we're having in this country? I mean, a lot of people are saying the time is ripe. Something is going to change. What did she think about the coverage of Ferguson and all of these bigger issues?
Well, I can certainly say that she had great concern around the coverage of African men and boys and men and boys of color in general, and sort of the framing around the narrative and the real understanding that images really shape perception. She often quoted a really incredible study, the Dellums Commission report done by Dr. Robert Entman, and about how that media images truly impact perception and shape unconscious bias. And sort of coming into focus of understanding that the media really has to understand that it really impacts all of our perceptions across race, class, culture, generation, and geography, which are the fault lines that the Maynard Institute is known for in its reporting framework. And so when you think about what the impact of this is, and then you align that with the concerns that you just outlined about the lack of diversity within news organizations, and the really what is the mechanism and pathway for addressing that at a time when the nation is becoming browner and more diverse, the news organizations, whether legacy or even new media, are becoming less diverse. And there isn't really a pathway to change that. And so she was very focused on that and concerned about the coverage that news organizations were doing. We held a number of public forums around Trayvon Martin when that shooting happened. And so it was something that she was really beginning to focus even to a greater extent on and understanding the impact of those perceptions and bias and how it shaped coverage.
What would you add to that, Linda?
Well, Dory and I would talk about these issues as two executive directors, two management level, you know, people. And from that point of view, it was much more personal. I think for her, I think she was beginning to change. She was having some deep thoughts about how far how much more outspoken she felt she needed to be, mm-hmm. and where she was going to take Maynard in that direction. I think that she wanted, I think she felt it was time to get out of her comfort zone. But she had to do it her own way. She wasn't going to stick it to the man, so to speak. She was going to do it her own way. And I think that this whole year she spent while she was ill, she was clearly thinking about the fact that she might probably wouldn't be around. And she was thinking about what she was going to leave behind so that other people could carry on that work.
That is Linda Ju. She is executive director of the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism, whose mission is to cultivate and support more public interest and investigative stories produced by journalists of color, women, and youth. Martin Reynolds is community engagement editor for the Oakland Tribune and chair of the Maynard Institute Board's task force. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we discuss coverage of the week's news. And today, we are remembering Dorie Maynard, tireless advocate of diversity in the media and president of the Robert C. Maynard Institute of Journalism Education, which was named for her father, the legendary African-American reporter, editor, and publisher. And Dorie died from lung cancer on February 24th at the age of 56. And what are your thoughts on these issues? How do you think the media images really shape your perception and shape your bias? What are your thoughts on the lack of diversity in the media? When do you really feel it? Because the numbers just bear this out. The percentage of people of color in newsrooms has stagnated at between 12 and 13% for more than a decade. This is according to the American Society of News Editors. People of color make up only 10% of newsroom supervisors, and the percentage of women in the newsroom has never exceeded 38%. So what are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. When we're talking about something like Ferguson and these issues across the country, I mean, this DOJ report just came out that showed overwhelmingly blacks are pulled over, they pay more fines. That's how the city brings in a lot of their revenue. I mean, these are clear-cut statistics. So how do you think the media are really dealing with these issues? 866-798-8255. And if there's something that stands out for you this week, we'd love to hear about it. And now I would like to welcome Sally Lerman to the show. Sally is a longtime friend and collaborator with Dorie Maynard. She's an award-winning journalist who covers science and social issues. And she leads the Digital Journalism Initiative at Santa Clara University. Hi, Sally. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you, and thanks for doing this show. It's so important and interesting to talk about Dorie's legacy and the work she's done.
Well, you wrote just a really great remembrance. And what really stands out for you when you think about what really drove Dorie to do this work until the very end?
Well, you know, I think that a lot of it had to do with her love for journalism and her commitment to democracy, really. I mean, I know that sounds sort of like a big deal, but there's a certain sense that the people really deserve to have a voice in their own future and that the news media have a responsibility to enable that voice. And at every stage, there was just this love for journalism as a force, as an enabling tool that could serve all of us.
You know, something that really struck me in the articles about Dorie, and there were many, hardly any of them pointed out the abysmal statistics. There's a lot of statistics on women in the media, some about people of color, but they're rarely broken down. And I wonder, Sally, why do you think that was missing? I mean, if we're talking about a woman who fought for diversity, you would think that it would be kind of logical for a reporter to look up these stats. Sally? Did we lose Sally?
Did you lose me?
Oh, go ahead. You're there.
Oh, okay. Hold on. Excuse me. I think that's a great point. And, you know, I can't explain why they didn't look it up, but I think it gets to some of the roots of our problems with diversity is that we don't go back to the roots of the problem. And that was the kind of thing that Dorie kept trying to bring us back to, and that is looking at the statistics, calling the news media accountable and in a way that encouraged people to do more. And so I think as an institution, journalism is not very good at looking at itself and asking questions about itself, and that may be why you saw those sorts of missing pieces in the coverage of her the work that she had done.
Yeah, Linda, that really struck me. I thought, piece after piece after piece, they're not really hard to find. I mean, it is hard to find the breakdown, especially when you're talking about people of color. But, you know, finding info from the American Society of News Editors, the Women's Media Project, I mean, the stats are out there, but why aren't they included in these stories?
Well, you know, the stories were about Dory. And I think that there was kind of an implicit assumption about what you're talking about in terms of the numbers.
Hmm.
And maybe it was just not the right time or place to start getting into an issue, to the big issues around this. It was really about Dory's passing. But I will tell you this. At her memorial service, there was a bit of fire and brimstone about this issue.
Hmm.
Maybe a bit too much, but it was clearly on everybody's minds that the needle hasn't moved that much since the American Society of Newspaper Editors, that's what it was called then, had determined that they were going to try to reach, quote, parity in the newsrooms by bringing up the numbers of journalists of color. And as much as it's not to say that there haven't been real efforts made at it, but the problem is much more complicated than simple recruitment. And there are bigger issues involved in changing the institutional culture and in the education of journalists in general around these issues that just simple recruitment can't overcome.
Martin, you were also at the memorial, and I understand that people who've been fighting for these issues for decades spoke about how far we've come and how far we haven't come. What really stood out for you?
Well, I think what stood out is something that that Linda is just alluding to, was that this notion that recruitment is enough, when in fact, once you get into an organization, retention has been a real problem for journalists of color in organizations, especially those that are going up into management, because they're then swirling around in an environment that isn't necessarily welcoming, conducive. There isn't necessarily mentors within the organization to sort of help them. They may be across the industry, but they're not necessarily in your room or down the hall. And so it really, what's a real problem here is that the whole sort of infrastructure of recruitment, retaining, and then really having a long career in these sort of legacy organizations, and even some of these new media organizations, is a real problem for journalists of color and also for women.
Sally, I understand you did media trainings with Dory. Do you want to talk about that and why that is so important?
Yeah, and let me preface that a little bit with the idea that Dory, and I think many of the people who work in this diversity arena in journalism now, was thinking forward to the idea that we've been trying to move this needle on staffing for a long time, and there is a lot of work to be done, and particularly in the new media area, I think, and under helping technology and new media companies understand that diversity needs to be at center. Beyond that, some of the things that Dory was moving into is, and has been doing for a long time, was helping all journalists, whatever your background, understand how to cross the bridges of our fault lines. And that was a tool that her father invented, the fault lines framework, that she then breathed life into and applied. It showed journalists how to apply it, showed college educators how to apply it in such a way that they could do a much better job understanding how to think about an issue or an event in the news in a way beyond their own personal, what their own personal experience brought to it, how to think about sources and diversify their sources, and even how to have conversations and conduct interviews in such a way that it didn't elicit resistance or kind of expected kinds of responses, but was able to help the journalists get behind what people were really thinking and what they anticipated. This is how this event might affect them.
Well, Sally, I know we have to let you go, so thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your article.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That is Sally Lerman. She's a longtime friend of Dory Maynard, and when we come back, we'll talk about why diversity in the media is so important. It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in today's conversation. On the telephone, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send your question or comment via email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up next at 11 o'clock, here on Local Public Radio. A new program on the Friday schedule, Inflection Point. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will kick off a series about California's water crisis. January was the driest in the state since record keeping began in 1895. February was the hottest. The sad fact is it's just not raining. So what does this mean for the snowpack, for the water reserves, for the wells? What explains all of this? How are state officials dealing with this crisis? And what is the responsibility of citizens? We'll kick that week-long series off by talking about the drought on Monday. We'll also be doing shows about food and water choices, about groundwater, and then we'll have a Friday show covering all of these issues. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today it's our media roundtable, and we're talking about diversity in the media. Dori Maynard, a tireless advocate of diversity and president of the Maynard Institute, died from lung cancer on February 24th. She was 56. We're talking about her life and the importance of diversity in the media with Martin Reynolds, community engagement editor for the Oakland Tribune and chair of the Maynard Institute Board's Task Force, and Linda Ju, executive director of the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism, whose mission is to cultivate and support public interest and investigative stories by journalists of color, women, and youth. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Why is diversity in the media so important? It's kind of an obvious question, but it's important to really talk about at a time when, according to the Radio and Television Digital News Association, people of color in the U.S. over the last 22 years have risen by 10%, but the percentage of people of color in TV news is up only 3%, and in radio, not even 1%. So what are your thoughts on that, and how does that shape the way we see ourselves and we see each other, and also form our opinions about important issues? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And now I would like to welcome Venice Wagner to the show. Venice is assistant professor and associate chair of the journalism department at San Francisco State University. Hi, Venice. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, I mean, this is such an obvious question, but I think it's important. Why are these issues so important? Why is diversity in the media so important?
Well, I think there's some ethical underpinnings, too, that we need to recognize. And in journalism, we are supposed to be reflecting the community that we're covering. And if we're not reflecting that community, then we're not being completely truthful or even accurate. So this is really an accuracy issue. It's an ethical issue. We need to get everyone's voices out there. This is part of the democratic process where we're hearing from everyone. It's a pluralistic society. And if we're not hearing from everyone, then really, we're not fully debating issues that need to be debated.
So I'm reading the statistics, right? 12 to 13% of newsroom employees are people of color. The percentage of women has never exceeded 38%. Pretty bad numbers when you look at television, radio. In fact, we did a show about Native American media about 4 or 5 months ago. And according to the latest data, there's not one Native American working in television, and very few in radio. So when you see these pretty bad stats, how does that affect what we're reading and hearing?
Well, it means that we're probably not getting the full spectrum. And I think there's some other issues. I think I heard Linda and Martin say it's not just a recruiting issue, it's also a retention issue. But even further than that, it's also an infrastructure issue. And that is to say that the way news is told, the way we go out there and report, often results in the kind of things that we're seeing now. We don't really see a lot of depth in journalism or in stories. We don't really see a lot of exploration of root causes of things. In the case of the Ferguson uprising or issues that are happening out of Ferguson, we don't really get to some of the root causes of why people are so upset there. So that is essentially what happens when we are not diverse and not only in our makeup, but in our thinking.
A caller just asked, how many people of color are in journalism schools? Do any of you know?
No, I don't.
It probably depends on the journalism school. At San Francisco State, we're doing pretty well. I think we have close to 25% Latino, but we don't have many African Americans, and we're probably about 12% Asian Americans. But African Americans, especially African American men, we really have a very difficult time. And I would say that that's the case at the university as a whole, not just in the journalism department.
And again, I mentioned these numbers before, but this is important. When you look at internships, that's how so many of us got our start. In the 1990s, people of color made up about 40% of newsroom interns. It's down to 26%. Martin, you work at the Oakland Tribune. What is it like there?
Well, I work, I work for all of Bay Area news groups, so it's not just the Trib. We're just sort of this large organization that covers in multiple newsrooms. And I would say that we've also, I mean, while we have a managing editor at the Oakland Tribune as an African-American woman, the staffing numbers have diminished and across the organization, despite we still have about 200 journalists. But absolutely, the diversity is certainly an issue in communities like Oakland. Certainly not. We have no Asian American reporters, and so we really have no entry point into the very large and robust Asian community in Oakland, which is a real problem. So, yeah, it's definitely a concern.
Linda, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I do. I just want to elaborate a little bit more about the infrastructure issue. I think that it really is, getting beyond the numbers, because the discussion is always about the numbers, and it's never about changing the culture of the media and changing the way we do, how we cover stories. And really, that's at the crux of why it's been difficult to change the numbers. I can give you an example. About a decade ago, I was working at the Independent Press Association, and we received funding to convene organize a gathering that was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Foundation, at their conference center, the Pocantico Center. And we convened some of the top people in the magazine business, both in the mainstream business, magazines, and also in the independent magazine world. These were people who were committed to diversity. And for 3 days, we talked about what the problems have been. And one story in particular stayed with me to this day, and that was Senior Vice President at that time, Joe Ferrer, who was the big champion of, I'm sorry, Senior Vice President at Time, Inc., Joe Ferrer, was a big champion of getting more journalists of color working for Time. And he had made a great deal of progress. But at the time that we held this meeting, he was about to retire, and he expressed his fears that everything that he had accomplished would disappear after he left. And in fact, that's pretty much what happened. So the reason why is because while he was the one man crusading for getting more journalists of color into the organization, there was nobody else there committed to that.
So how did that happen exactly? I mean, I've read that when we've got downturns and when media institutions lay people off, it's usually people of color are the first to go. Why is that?
Why is that? That's a good question.
What?
Go ahead, Martin.
I think some of it is the uncertainty. I think some of it is that the people of color, depending on if you're in union shop, may have been first hired, which means first fired quite often. Sometimes people just they just don't feel as though they're going to have the kind of security in the organization, and so they look elsewhere. I certainly know some of my colleagues. I went through a Maynard training years ago, back in 2005 or 2007, and at least half of that class is no longer in journalism anymore. Now, some of that is due to the downturn, but a substantial amount, a part of that is because where they were on the totem pole when they were hired, and the environments in which they were working in. But I will say this, that there is some efforts underway now at ASNE and APME, which are now sort of working together. ASNE is American Society of News Editors. APME is the Associated Press Media Editors. And there is a real effort. We have a great chair of the AS&E Diversity Committee, Karen Magnuson. She was very committed to diversity. So there is some efforts underway, particularly a pilot project with the folks from Journalism That Matters around community engagement and also how you can utilize community engagement to intersect with diverse communities. So there's an understanding now that it is, as this community engagement concept becomes more into focus, that this can also be a mechanism by which communities can be engaged across the demographic diaspora.
And Venice, what would you add to that?
I think you also can't discount part of the issue is salaries. I mean, some students of color are finishing university with significant debt, and they need to pay it off. And so at some point when they're looking for jobs, they might be able to start with an internship that doesn't really pay a whole lot. And it's very difficult to sort of sustain themselves when they still have student debt to pay off, et cetera, et cetera. And so part of it is sort of a financial piece. And we know that a lot of newsrooms are undergoing very, you know, significant cuts. They're hiring at very low salaries, and that makes it difficult for a lot of young people right now.
And that is Venice Wagner, Assistant Professor and Associate Chair of the Journalism Department at San Francisco State. Martin Reynolds is Community Engagement Editor for the Oakland Tribune and Chair of the Maynard Institute Board's Task Force. Linda Jew is Executive Director of the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism. Their mission is to cultivate and support public interest and investigative stories produced by journalists of color, women, and youth. And today we are talking about the importance of diversity in the media in light of the death of Dorie Maynard. She died from lung cancer on February 24th. She was 56. She was president of the Robert C. Maynard Institute of Journalism Education. It was named for her father, the legendary African-American reporter, editor, and publisher. And we'd love to hear from you. Are these issues that you think about? When we're talking about diversity in the media, it really shapes our perception, it shapes our bias, it shapes how we view each other, ourselves, and our opinions about really important issues. So what really stands out for you? And at a time when race is getting so much attention, we just saw that racist fraternity student video from the University of Oklahoma. It has generated strong reactions from politicians, from the university president, the student body. We have the DOJ report on Ferguson. Looking at all of the attention on race, do you think that it has really generated an in-depth conversation about these issues and how we got here? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What do you think, Linda? Do you think that all of this stuff has generated in-depth conversations and reporting?
I think it's generated both in-depth conversation and a lot of the usual kinds of conversations. Certainly, you know, I think that with Black Lives Matter, they feel that they have to organize in order to get their voices out because their stories are not being told properly by the media. Now, on the other hand, Black Lives Matter is also generating fear among the white supremacists and the racists, frankly. And I think that we've got some very, very sensitive conversations that we need to have that this country doesn't know how to have, and that we in the media have not been able to facilitate that conversation.
So as someone who's judging some of the best investigative reporting across the country, what story do you think needs to be written? I mean, if the New York Times came to you and said, all right, Linda, we're going to go fund an investigative piece, what's missing?
That's a big question. And it wouldn't just be one story.
Yeah. Do you think it'd be like history? Do you think we need to focus more on that? Because we did a show about housing policies and how that really affects so much of what we're facing today.
Yeah. I would say that daily news reporting and news reporting in general needs to have the kind of depth and context that perhaps you might find in the better intellectual magazines that have actually looked at the problem of Ferguson from a historical perspective and analyzed some of the issues around segregation in St. Louis and that are reflective of metropolitan areas all across the country. Now, I would say daily news, because they're driven by that daily news cycle, they don't do that. And also budget reasons. They don't have the kind of staffing and resources to pursue stories in depth in that way that maybe magazines that can afford the narrative length are able to do.
Venice, how would you analyze the reporting that we're seeing now, so much reporting on race?
Well, I think what we tend to see are stories about what one author called race panics. You know, these sort of things happen. The fraternity in Oklahoma is busted for, you know, saying really racist things. A while ago, I think maybe a year and a half ago at San Jose State, one kid was being harassed. There was a noose hanging from his room, and he was called three-fifths and this kind of thing. And so I think we get these stories that are very charged, and they're clearly showing that there's racist behavior. But what we don't see in the news are some of these subtle things that happen. Like, we don't see a clear explanation, for example, of health disparities, or we don't see a very clear explanation of even the education gap, which is all very, very complicated. But it's really important to get at some of those complexities if we're going to understand how to come up with solutions, right?
We're actually going to do a show about segregation in schools in 2 Mondays. San Francisco Public Press did a really good, had a front page in-depth investigation about the resegregation of schools in San Francisco. So take note of that. And then Martin...
And that was absolutely a very, very good piece.
Right. Yeah, they're doing really good work. Martin, mm-hmm. What about you? How do you assess coverage that we're seeing today on race?
Well, I think the coverage is very reactionary, and it's not very nuanced. And I think their news organizations should be taking much more of the lead of helping to serve in that role of convener and facilitator. I mean, I think, for instance, APME and ASNE do these national projects around infrastructure or broken budgets, where newspapers from across the country will align their coverage around these large national issues, right? It seems to be that we ought to be doing something about that on race, and that there's a coordinated effort across multiple news organizations across the country, multiple platforms that align coverage and conversation together. So if the New York Times came to me and said, hey, we want to take the lead in this, that's what I would propose. I said, how can we do a national reporting project on race that is probative, that's reflective, that's nuanced, that's inclusive, and that takes some time and brings this conversation in a way that together rather than all this reactionary coverage? It's not really coverage about race. It's coverage about incidents, and it's coverage about emotions.
Right.
But it's not really coverage about race.
That's very well put.
Yeah, that's right. I agree.
Well, we have a caller who wants to talk about the impact of images, so let's hear from Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks very much. I'll try to make this as short as I can, but I recently watched a sort of feel-good dog rescue movie about a woman who was bit by a pit bull and then saved one that had been horribly injured. And it was an all-white movie, but the perpetrator was black. And, you know, it may be that the producers were trying to keep to the truth of the story, because it's supposed to be a true story. But I sat down and wrote an email to them, and I understood from their reaction that they didn't even think about it when it happened. And it made me realize the importance of having people of color in every, you know, media to think of those things, you know, and because that had a huge impact on me.
What kind of impact did it have on you?
Well, first of all, I was shocked, and then I was just, like, angry because I felt like, you know, here was this movie that was going along and people were all wonderful and blah, 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 and then you have this big, bad black man come into the scene and then he's vanquished, you know. And I thought, you know, what kind of message is that giving? I was upset. And the reason I'm upset is because I'm imagining a lot of people would see that without even realizing what they're seeing and internalize that message.
Well, thank you for calling. I mean, there have been documentaries and books written about this stuff. Does anyone want to jump in there and talk about that and the way that it, just what we see in the media?
Well, there's interesting. There's a great example today. This was the other good example I was going to give about good journalism. The All Digitocracy site, Tracy Powell's site that looks at issues around media. There's another example where the show The Real had a segment yesterday about making quesadillas, and the hosts all put on these hats and mustaches and ponchos, basically doing this caricature of Mexican men to make quesadillas, and they thought that was cute. And so there was a lot of people getting upset with them on Twitter, and sort of like they thought, well, what's the problem? We're just trying to be funny. But what's ironic is that all of these women are women of color on the show for the most part, and they all talk about empowering women, but yet they still felt that it was okay to sort of stereotype Latino men. And the good, and they haven't really apologized about it. So it's sort of like, who is in these production meetings making these kind of decisions? And there's no one around the room, and sometimes people just, there's not someone there to say, hey, what are you thinking? But the also point is this, is that you can't always have people of color in news organizations serve as sort of the canary in the coal mine for dumb decisions that are made in coverage. Like oh, all of a sudden, what do you think? Should we put a picture of a young black boy eating watermelon on the front page today? No, fool, you should know that you shouldn't do that.
And so, can I dovetail on that? Because, you know, in my classes, one of the things I teach students, I think there's this sense that white students cannot, for as an example, cover issues in the black community or the Asian community. They don't feel equipped to do that. And so the biggest problem that I think is out there is that people don't feel equipped to make any news decisions or judgments about what is important and what is not important unless they're part of that community. Well, the point is you have to become a part of that community. You can't be isolationist. You can't just sort of stick with your own folks. You have to immerse yourself in lots of different parts of community, and that's how you begin to change the thinking. You won't think about how racist it is to put on a poncho and a mustache and a hat while you're making quesadillas unless you're actually a part of that community.
Venice, what can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of the conversations that you're hearing in your classrooms around these issues, just all of the attention that race is getting in the media?
Yeah, I mean, I think students really want to do the right thing. They care, but they don't really feel like they can do it. I mean, it's very easy for them to critique what they see. They have lots of really good critiques. They say, oh, well, for example, we were looking at a clip from NBC that was writing about, or season that was airing something on the DOJ report about Ferguson. And they didn't really cover much of anything about what was in the report. And so students actually took note of that, and they were, you know, doing very, very good critiques. But what I'm finding is when they are doing their own reporting, they fall into some of the same traps that they were critiquing. And the reason that happens is because it's really difficult to get outside of your comfort zone. So part of what has to happen and part of what I try to train my students to do is to push yourself through fear. You're afraid of approaching the black guy on the corner? Well, swallow it and go talk to the black guy on the corner.
Yeah, I want to actually jump in a little bit more and say something about that. I think that in general, as journalists, we're not actually trained to look at our own biases in general, not just about race but about everything. And I think that's a major flaw in the way that journalists are trained. And frankly, whatever liberal arts education that we're supposed to have before we become journalists or before we go into journalism graduate school is really inadequate in providing that kind of understanding historically, and even sociologically and anthropologically about the society that we're supposed to be reporting on. So, and then to actually ask students to try to develop that sensibility while they're learning how to write and report and master the technology and do everything else is a huge task, because what you're talking about is changing your mindset. And that should start way before they ever even are trained to become journalists.
And also we should note that young people today feel the pressure to know all platforms of technology, to know how to shoot video, to get audio, to shoot photographs, and to write the story.
Exactly.
I mean, I ran into a great reporter who used to work for The Guardian, and she said, I'm a reporter, I interview people, I don't know how to do this video stuff, and I'm afraid that I'm not going to find a job because I can't do all these other things.
Right. The whole emphasis has been basically on kind of making sure that the assembly line of information production is moving smoothly.
So given that, what changes would you like to see? I mean, what do you think would help?
You know, journalism is actually changing altogether in how we define what kind of content we produce, but And it's mostly on the edges right now and slowly moving in toward the center as people drop out of newsrooms and are forced to create new kinds of journalism, particularly in nonprofit journalism. So, you know, there's a heavy bias. There has been a heavy bias by traditional journalists about, quote, advocacy journalism. Yet, in point of fact, most of the nonprofit news entities that are arising today are all, quote, mission-driven. That means that they care about the content they produce and the impact it has on engaging their audience and also making any kind of positive change in society. So that there have been pockets of us throughout many years that have believed in this, but we've always kind of hidden in the corners because we've been accused of advocacy journalism, which is completely ridiculous. But now the conversation is coming more into the mainstream, and even funders are beginning to think about that more because nonprofit journalism is funded by philanthropists who often have social justice or social responsibility goals.
Right.
So, and then that brings up the tension of, well, okay, are we going to pursue the foundation's agenda or how independent are we going to be? But nonetheless, we're having that conversation now.
Hmm. Well, Martin, final thoughts from you. We've got about a minute and a half left.
Okay. Well, I just want to also say, sort of bringing it back to Dory and the Institute, is that, you know, there's a lot of questions about what is going to happen now with the Institute after her passing. And I just want to let people know that the board is very active and very engaged in she already had begun to seed sort of this new strategic planning process. And so we're going to take that really by the bull by the horns, and we're going to continue the legacy of the Maynard Institute because its mission is as important now as it ever has been. And so I want to assuage any concerns or fears that the Institute will not go on. It will go on, and that legacy will find a new place in this new dynamic that is our media today.
And, Venice, final thoughts from you, about 30 seconds.
Sure. I just want to say how much I just appreciate all the work that Dory has done. And I think what I admire most about what I witnessed her doing was her ability to talk about these really sensitive and touchy subjects for a lot of people, but do it in a quiet way that actually had impact. I mean, she never had a moment where she put someone sort of in a corner. She always did it in such an open and inviting way. And I just want to acknowledge that and try to follow that as much as I can.
Venice Wagner is Associate Chair of the Journalism Department at SF State. Martin Reynolds is Community Engagement Editor for the Oakland Tribune and Chair of the Maynard Institute Board's Task Force. And Linda Jew is Executive Director of the G.W. Williams Center for Independent Journalism. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How bad is California's drought? On the next Your Call, we'll kick off a week-long series on California's water crisis. January was the driest month in the state since record-keeping began in 1895, and February was the hottest. The fact is, it's just not raining. As a result, California has just 1 year of water reserves, wells are running dry, and the Sierra snowpack is far below normal. So how are state officials responding, and what's the responsibility of citizens? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.